Україна на Майдан!
Я думаю, це початок боротьби за українську незалежність. Україна повинна
багатая страна, которая заслуживает.
Только в Киеве накануне вечером на Майдан вышли около 2000
человек. Большинство на Майдане уверены, что ассоциация с ЕС...
Год с начала украинского Майдана. Майдана,
по сути, была обычным госпереворотом.
Новый праздник, День достоинства и свободы, годовщина начала Евромайдана.
It began appropriately for our times with a post on a young man's Facebook page. 3 months later, it toppled a president. But the euphoria of Ukraine's democratic Euromaidan revolution didn't last long. It was followed by an undeclared invasion by neighboring Russia, the first forceful change in borders in Europe since World War II, and an undeclared war that continues to this day. 1 year ago, the Euromaidan began, and neither Ukraine nor Russia will ever be the same again. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome, Sean.
Hey, Brian.
And also joining us via Skype from New York City is Alexander Motil, a professor at Rutgers University, Newark, and author of numerous books on post-Soviet affairs. Welcome back, Alexander. It's good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for agreeing to come on. It's been one hell of a ride this past year, and it ain't over by a long shot. But the world on November 21st, 2014 looks a whole hell of a lot different than the world on November 21st, 2013. And nowhere is this more apparent, of course, than in Ukraine and Russia. In many ways, this past year was the time when the mask came off, so to speak. Ukraine has made its choice and has decided to go west and is paying for that choice with the loss of Crimea and an ongoing war in the Donbas. And the Putin regime has made its choice as well. Not only is it most certainly not going west, but it's also not going to let Ukraine do so either, at least not without a fight. And it's certainly willing to upend the post-war international order to attain its goals. So let's take inventory here. Sean, how do you see Russia and Ukraine changing over the past year? What has each gained? What has each lost? And where do each appear to be headed?
Well, it would be hard to categorize everything that has changed and what has been gained and what has been lost. But some of the things that kind of stand out to me is that we see now, and this really began in 2008 with Russia and Russia-Georgia war, but we see Russia now trying to rewrite the rules of the post-Cold War world. Russia is now in a strong power again. It was weak in the 1990s and basically had to settle on the post-Cold War rules. Now it's trying to change them. And is trying to change them by exerting its pressure most militarily into eastern Ukraine and trying to destabilize Ukraine as much as it can to prevent Ukraine at least from going further west to reform itself and certainly at the possibility of joining NATO in the future. Some of the things that have also changed, Russia seems to have turned more inward. You have basically an anti-cosmopolitan campaign going on in Russia where things that are seen as Western is being denounced and more towards an attempt of Russian autarky economically but also culturally to some extent. You see Russia turning to the east, looking to China as a potential partner, both in gas but also a potential political alliance. Some of the things have been lost because of that is Russia has become more isolated. You have sanctions against it that seem to be working to hobble its economy. The ruble is depreciating. And Russia is increasingly being viewed as a rogue state. In terms of Ukraine, one of the things that strikes me that has been gained is you get the development of a political Ukrainian identity, where Ukrainian patriotism has bound the people of Ukraine together vis-a-vis Russia. But you also have a wave of patriotism also in Russia as well. And this has been translated into high approval ratings in terms of Putin's popularity. So these are just some of the things. These are this is not all the to categorize what has changed and what has been lost and what has been gained. In terms of where Russia and Ukraine are going, this is really difficult to say. It seems the last couple of weeks there's been a buildup of military by Russia into eastern Ukraine, and the threat of war, open warfare. The ceasefire was never really a ceasefire, but open warfare seems to be on the horizon. And this, I think, will make the conflict even more bloody and more destabilizing than before.
Alexander, anything you'd add to that?
A number of things. Thank you for asking. I happen to think that Putin made a strategic mistake, one that he and Russia will pay a very high price for, in this attempt to rewrite the rules of the international order and so on. You can do that, maybe, if you're a superpower, although the United States arguably tried in the last 10 years and didn't exactly succeed. If you're a middle-range power, or, as some people say, a Belgium with a bomb, and I think that's not a wholly inaccurate description of Russia's power capacity.
The Belgians might take offense to that, but...
they might take offense, but it's not exactly inappropriate. I don't think you're supposed to, it is not wise strategically to take on the entire developed world, the United States and the European Union, unless you're absolutely certain you can actually pull this off. And I don't think he can, Putin, that is to say. And this move to the east, this alliance or semi-alliance or growing economic ties with China is another strategic mistake, fundamentally brought about by the first strategic mistake, namely trying to take on the entire West. China is significantly larger and stronger in every sense than Russia, and the relationship of Russia to China is roughly approximate to that of Ukraine to Russia. Russia was a hegemon. Now it's essentially making itself into the supplier of raw materials to a highly developed economy. This is not the way to go economically, politically, or strategically. So my sense is that Putin has backed Russia into an enormous corner, or rather into a very small corner. He made a strategic mistake and backed it off into a small corner. He's alienated the West. He's transformed Russia into a rogue state. He has fundamentally, totally, completely, absolutely lost Ukraine. And what he's done and what he's accomplished is essentially very little. I don't see any particular benefits for Russia. And when I think back a year ago, where was Russia? Well, it was not exactly the darling of the world, but it was doing well. And most people in the West regarded it with some degree of respect, if not love. It certainly had Ukraine in its pocket. And this, of course, is another strategic mistake. Had Ukraine signed the association agreement, that would not have changed Ukraine's relationship with Russia for many, many years, if at all, because it would have guaranteed Yanukovych's re-election in 2015. And Yanukovych's re-election in 2015 would have guaranteed that Ukraine would have remained a vassal state of Russia. End of story. And the Ukrainians would have felt a little better because they would have had this opportunity possibly to travel a bit more in Western Europe. But fundamentally, the power relationship would not have changed. Putin brought about the Maidan Euro revolution. He essentially destroyed Yanukovych. He lost Ukraine, and he transformed Russia into a rogue state that is now rapidly becoming, a supplier of raw materials to highly developed China, which, unlike the West, is not a wimp and will insist on paying as little as possible for all the goodies that it gets. In contrast, Ukraine, yes, there is a war, and that is the major negative. And it is killing people, and that is likely to continue for the foreseeable future. On the other hand, for the first time in 24 years, and I'll repeat some of the things that Sean very wisely said, Ukraine has a national identity, thanks to Putin. There's nothing like having a sense of hostility and an existential threat to force people to concentrate their minds. And many Ukrainians, if not indeed most Ukrainians, have decided that this particular state in this particular territory with this particular political and national configuration is the state and territory and country with which they will associate themselves. And that's likely to be, I mean, I think that's a fundamental sea change. Ukraine has always been looking for this national identity. Thanks to Putin, it's gotten it. By the same token, for the first time in 24 years, most Ukrainians are of the opinion that they belong in the West. Mm-hmm. That was never the case in the past, even with regard to NATO membership.
Yeah, I know.
Regardless of whether that's good or bad or desirable or not, but as you know from public opinion surveys, Ukrainians in general, I mean, it used to be about 15% to 20% max that supported NATO membership. Now it's over 50%.
It's over 50. Yeah, yeah. No, I just got off a brief broadcast on our Current Time television program, our Russian language television program, and I said Ukraine's one thing my takeaway now is Ukraine is definitely going west. The only tragic question we still have is how many people have to die before they firmly arrive there. Conclusively, and that's the one I wanted to return. But just to sum up, I mean, Sean, you see a mixed bag. Alexander, you see more of a. The year's been a net plus for Ukraine and a net minus for Russia when you really step back and look at it. Is that a fair?
Absolutely.
Where Sean, you see a little bit more of a mixed bag.
Yeah, I see a bit of more big mixed bag because I think the story that's going on in eastern Ukraine hasn't been fully written yet. The question of Putin's motives, everybody's been wondering exactly what Putin's motives are. And at the minimum, it seems to be to destabilize the country and Ukraine enough to prevent it from moving on and reforming itself and moving towards the West. I mean, something that Alexander wrote, I think, a month or so ago, basically arguing that Ukraine should give up the Donbass. I thought that was a really good idea because it's preventing Ukraine from moving on and keeping this region. You might as well let the Russians deal with it, let them rebuild it, let them fund it, and Ukraine can move on to the West without it.
Yeah, that article was actually quite prophetic. It was actually before the annexation of Crimea. I know because I interviewed you right after that article, Alexander, and it was almost prophetic. What you wrote there, but I think Kyiv is wise to this right now. And if they can't say it out loud, you're not going to hear Poroshenko say this or Yatsenyuk say this. But they seem to be doing this de facto, from my vantage point. Alexander, I don't know if that's what it looks like to you.
Certainly looks that way to me. Again, I don't know what their thinking is. I'm not sure anybody knows, but certainly based on the kinds of actions that they've followed, and you know, over the last 2 months, essentially. Ukraine seems to be withdrawing from this enclave.
Yeah.
You know, other than, you know, for one thing, they're not attacking. So that's interesting. But nevertheless,
they're not financing either.
They're not financing, which is significant. But something that, you know, fewer people are aware of is that something like 10 higher educational institutions have been withdrawn from the Donbass and placed within other cities in Ukraine. So that shows that something like an institutional shift willy-nilly is taking place, whereby Ukraine, that is to say the Kyiv authorities, are essentially withdrawing their presence from the enclave and essentially saying, you know, you guys, you want this, you run it.
Well, yeah, this reminds me of an interesting conversation I had with Peter Pomerantsev a couple weeks back. He was here at RFE for a visit, and he said basically what's happening now is both sides want to lose this thing the right way, because Ukraine seems to be without anybody daring say anything in public, wants to basically be rid of this. But they want to be rid of it in the right way. Russia really doesn't want it. Does Russia want to finance that mess now and rebuild it? Because if you broke it, you own it, man. And neither of these territories, Luhansk or Donetsk, are viable as independent states. I mean, that's just utterly laughable. Alexander, you mentioned NATO. It actually is, I mean, I'm sure you both saw the news today. The coalition agreement was leaked to the Ukrainian media, and Ukraine is abandoning its non-aligned status and is formally again seeking NATO membership. And for that to make it into the coalition agreement, well, that would mean the whole coalition has to agree on it, which therefore means they have a very strong majority to do that in parliament, and which I would assume reflects the society's wishes if the latest public opinion polls are correct. Something I wanted to return to is you both said it, and I had it in my things I wanted to talk about. This is the year Russia became a rogue state. their behavior this year isn't that different from their behavior in the past. They've just dialed it up to 11, so to speak, this year. Because let's face it, what they're doing in Donbass isn't that different from what they did in Abkhazia, South Ossetia, Transnistria. So the big change was annexing Crimea. That was the formal annexation. But they've crossed red lines like that in the past when they recognized Abkhazia and South Ossetia's independence right after the Georgia War. But this is the year people are starting to recognize Russia as a rogue state. But Russia's always had this immunity because of this, because they had this status of whatever, a former superpower who we pretended was still a superpower. They have nukes. Their energy is important. Are they becoming a rogue state? Because when I think rogue state, I think Gaddafi's Libya. I think Saddam Hussein's Iraq. That label's never really applied to Russia. Have they lost their immunity to this label now?
Sean.
Okay. Whether Russia is a rogue state depends on how people perceive
exactly.
it. Certainly the perception has changed dramatically over the last year. But the only problem is, and I know we're going to talk about Alexander's article about containment in the second half, but the question is, what is the policy towards Russia? And this is something that you mentioned last week, Brian, in the podcast, that the Obama administration and the Obama administration's policy towards Russia will kind of determine the policy in the West in general, is what is their policy to Russia? Is Russia an adversary? Is it an enemy? Is it a partner? We don't really know. You suggested that it's moving more towards an enemy, and I think there's a lot of good arguments for that. But the problem is that Russia is also connected to the world. And how much can you make it a rogue state when it's supplying gas and it's supplying oil to developed countries? How much can you isolate it when it's important for Iran, dealing with Iran, dealing with Syria mm-hmm. and other places in the world? So it might, while it's certainly appearing to be a rogue state, or at least perceived to be a rogue state, the question is how much can you cancel it off from the rest of the world and isolate it?
It's too big. It's one way to summarize it. It's too big to be a rogue state, but not strong enough to be a superpower.
Right.
Alexander, what would you say to this?
It ultimately depends on what you mean by rogue state. I happen to think it has become a rogue state for the simple reason that whatever reputation it had in the past, and it did have a bit of a reputation as being a more or less reliable partner, as being someone you wanted to engage in, someone you wanted to incorporate in a variety of diplomatic and political activities, someone you could rely on, someone you could trust to a greater or lesser extent. Again, we're not talking about absolutes here. There was a sense that Russia could actually be that. And I think at this point, people were gritting their teeth. People are saying, well, yeah, we got to deal with these guys because they've got the energy, they've got the nukes, they still have clout in various parts of the world. And largely, we've got to deal with them because if we don't deal with them, they're going to cause trouble and force us to deal with them. But that's no longer a partner. That just happens to be a very big state that's become a real pain in the butt.
Right.
It would act normally, decently, semi-reliably, and the rest, and it's not. And a lot of this, I think, has to do with Putin himself. I mean, his image was always, he's obviously always been criticized, but his behavior and his statements over the last years have been so mendacious, so contradictory, so aggressive.
Yeah.
So, there's almost a kind of bipolar quality to him. And he's become a fearsome leader, not because he has important or good things to say, but because he's become the bull in the china shop.
Right. Yeah. And if you look at
reasons why we in the West don't quite know what to do with Putin, precisely because he's behaving exactly the wrong way in exactly the wrong place. Sooner or later, we'll figure something out. We'll either abandon the china shop or close the door or throw him out. I think it's leading in that second direction at the moment.
Looking at the G20 in Australia, I think we're beginning to see a glimpse of where this is going, because he was, I don't think I ever saw somebody ostracized at that kind of forum the way Putin was ostracized at that forum. That was pretty amazing to watch. Another thing, Alexander, when you talk about what Russia's lost this year, well, they've lost Germany.
Yes.
And that's no small thing.
Yeah, that's true.
That is no small thing. I saw there was two interesting articles that I read this week. One was a New York Times profile of Frank-Walter Steinmeier, the German foreign minister, who was, as we all know, one of the strongest advocates of closer cooperation and making Russia a partner. And he's really at his wit's end right now because he doesn't know. Angela Merkel, the chancellor, is pretty much, you know, she knows what she's looking at right now. Having grown up in the GDR, she knows what she's looking at and she doesn't like it one bit. But it's amazing to me that Putin's Russia miscalculated Germany so much because they just assumed that Germany would be their, if not Trojan horse in Europe, at least their advocate in Europe. And in Germany, let's face it, was for the longest time. But they've lost Germany, and that is big.
But you know,
go ahead, Sean.
Oh, but you know, it seems to me that one of the things that has happened over the last year is events have gone out of Russia's control. There's been a lot of debate whether does Putin have a strategy? Is he just doing tactics? How does he respond? Does he have a plan? And I tend to side on the side where he doesn't seem to have a plan. He's reacting to events, and things have spun out of his control. And as Alexander rightly put, he's backed himself into a corner. And of course, he miscalculated in losing Germany. But I wonder if he's completely miscalculated in thinking things would go this far.
Let's add to that. I mean, I fully agree with everything Sean has said. But he's not just lost Germany. What he's managed to do is unite the major European powers. It's been traditional Russian strategy to keep the Europeans disunited. He's managed to unite the Europeans with the Americans. And again, it's been the second principle of Russian policy to
divide them,
Americans and the Europeans to be. He's revivified NATO, for Christ's sake. Yeah. I mean, it was essentially a moribund institution that had lost every sense of identity, had no sense of purpose, wasn't sure why it existed. And now its core mission has been revived. NATO can now say, we are here in order to defend ourselves against potential aggression by Russia. And it's no longer a pie-in-the-sky argument. It's actually perfectly legitimate. So strategically, as I said, you know, at the beginning, I mean, he's taken on these major powers. He seems to have thought that it would be a piece of cake. Again, we can only assume he seems to have thought that. But in any case, at the end of the day, when you look what he's accomplished in the last year, is he's turned every one of these key institutions against Russia. That can't be good.
With a few little exceptions like Viktor Orban in Hungary, Milos Zeman here in the Czech Republic, who, although, you know, you saw the Zeman was booed fiercely, and a bunch of thousands of students showed up to show him the red card. But by and large, I agree with you. And I mean, I was at the NATO summit in Cardiff, and this is my fourth or fifth NATO summit that I've attended. And the energy that was present at that summit was like nothing I'd ever seen at a NATO summit before. And I was thinking, my God, NATO should build a monument to Putin in front of their headquarters in Brussels there. But One other thing I wanted to touch on before we move on to the second half is, I mean, how much is riding on Ukraine's success right now? Because I think a lot is riding on Ukraine's success right now. Putin's always had this asymmetrical advantage that Ukraine just doesn't really matter to the West, and it matters a lot to him. And he's gonna wear us down, and that may be true. But on the other hand, if what's left of Ukraine, and what's left of Ukraine is quite substantial, if you do write off the Donbas, and if you do write off Crimea, what's left of Ukraine is still substantial. It loses the industrial base. Alexander, you don't think that's a bad thing? I know from reading things you've written. There's a lot of talent there. There's a lot of human potential. You turn Ukraine into a success story. How important is that? Does this stop the Russian imperial project in its tracks? Does it restore the Western security system? And maybe does it have knock-on effects inside of Russia itself? Just making Ukraine a successful, relatively prosperous, democratic European country. How important is that for everything else?
I think it's absolutely, this is the key priority for Ukraine, obviously.
For Ukraine, yeah.
And I'm hopeful, and I'm pleased to see that many European and certainly American policymakers seem to appreciate the importance of Ukraine's successful transformation. As Brzezinski has always been saying, Russia with Ukraine is an empire. Russia without Ukraine has the opportunity to become a normal nation state and a democracy. And we're seeing that, as it were. I mean, this is being, you know, we're seeing this live. If Russia can be stopped, perhaps at the current borders. You know, maybe Ukraine will lose the enclave in Crimea, but fundamentally 90 to 95% of the Ukrainian territories, if they can remain more or less whole, and if they can embark on successful democratic and market-oriented reforms, this will stop Russia in its tracks. This will also have all sorts of very important knockoff effects within the post-Soviet states. As you know, Ukraine has been the only country, only big country, and then there's Moldova and Georgia to a certain degree, that have been able to avoid and escape this drift towards complete authoritarianism that has beset all the other non-Baltic post-Soviet states. If Ukraine can make it, then anybody can make it in principle. And of course, most importantly, that means Russia can make it. And I think that, and of course, Putin understands this very well. I mean, he's not afraid of NATO. He's not so much afraid of the West. He's afraid of the fact that the Ukrainian experiment could actually succeed and that Russians in general, Russian Democrats in particular, would then say, well, wait a second. If these guys can do it, why do we need you? Why can't we embark on our own colored revolution? Why not have a Maidan in Moscow and get rid of this kleptocracy that's been stealing from the country and misruling it for the past 15 years? So to my mind, Ukraine's importance is absolutely critical. And then last but not least is the fact that it's also geopolitically important. This is one of the points that many realist thinkers in the West, people like Mearsheimer and Kissinger and a number of others, don't fully appreciate. If Ukraine goes, I mean, this is not just about Ukraine. It ultimately becomes a question, and is indeed a question, about the security and stability of Europe, the security and stability of the European Union, NATO, and the West in general. So there are at least those three very important reasons for maintaining Ukraine's integrity, but more importantly, transforming it into a successful state. And successful doesn't mean it has to become Switzerland in the next 10 years. It would be perfectly fine if Ukraine were to be a Slovakia or a Romania even. But in any case, moving in that particular direction and getting its problems fixed along the way.
Sean, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important for Ukraine itself because, as I said, that you have this development of a political identity where Ukrainians are now seeing themselves as tied to this state, that Ukraine as a state is important, that we are patriots for Ukraine. And the country has gone through two revolutions in the last decade. And for it to fail again would cause more despair and more apathy within the country and really erode the whatever political institutions that have developed out of this Maidan revolution. So I think it's absolutely crucial for it to succeed in some marginal way, particularly on the issue of corruption. I think this is the main sticking point for the population. I agree with Alexander that it's incredibly important for it to succeed as an example to other post-Soviet states. As he said, if Ukraine can make it, then other potential states could too. And this could really rewrite the landscape of post-Soviet Eurasia. And particularly, I'm a little bit more skeptical on its influence on Russia, just because Putin, I think if Ukraine succeeds, we're going to get a further retrenchment of the Putin regime. And the question is, will there be a movement to actually overthrow the regime is a big question that I'm not so positive on.
Yeah, one thing to add to what both of you are saying, because another thing that struck me about this year is that this is the year that Ukrainian civil society really came of age. And it really became apparent, and it's still apparent right now, although the gap isn't as wide as it was in previous political elites, but the civil society is so far ahead of the political class. Just light years ahead of the political class. And this is one asset that I think has been underappreciated about Ukraine is that, and it'd be an interesting thing for future historians or maybe current sociologists to look at, like, why is it that the Ukrainian political culture is such that their civil society developed the way it did and turned into? I mean, I remember being in Ukraine in the early 90s, and it wasn't that different from Russia right after the Soviet collapse. You had nascent, like, kind of green shoots of civil society here and there, but what you see in Ukraine now, as compared to what you have in Russia, it's night and day. But the other thing is just how far ahead they are of the political class. Another thing, drawing on what both of you have said, is that I mean, if what Alexander you were saying about the crucial importance of this for everything else, and Sean as well. shouldn't Ukraine be at the center of our Russia policy right now? And we've been saying the U.S. doesn't have a Russia policy. Well, maybe that policy should be, as Alexander suggested, containment and is one part of it. But the other part is making damn sure that Ukraine is successful. And in this sense, the metaphor is overused. But, you know, Ukraine is the West Germany of our time. It's got to succeed. It's got to succeed, or else the whole European security system is in deep doo-doo, as the first President Bush would have said. Anything to add from either of you before we move on to the next section? Go ahead, Alexander.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It's got to succeed. It is the West Germany. That's the appropriate way to look at it. A number of very prominent individuals in the West, including Soros, George Soros, Anders Osland, and others, have suggested that Ukraine needs a Marshall Plan, or the equivalent of a Marshall Plan. Whether it has to be quite that enormous, I don't know. I'll leave that to the economists to determine. But certainly something along those lines would be appropriate. Mm-hmm. Obviously, with all sorts of conditionalities and strings attached. You don't want to give money to the Ukrainian elites without strings.
Yeah. Sean, anything else?
Yeah, I was going to add that a lot of it does depend on the Europeans and their commitment to propping up Ukraine and giving it money and giving it institutional support. And the fear that has been over the last year is are the Europeans going to get fatigued with Ukraine, especially if the internal dynamics of the country aren't going to really change, especially around the issue of corruption. So I think a lot of it depends on whether how much the Europeans have invested in Ukraine. And the more Putin reacts and escalates the problem, I think the more the Europeans would be invested.
Yeah. And again, at the end of the day, it's going to depend on the Ukrainians to reform this. And we just have to hope that this civil society can keep the pressure up on the Ukrainian political elite, and that sooner or later, this political elite's going to catch up to this rapidly politically maturing society. Well, we're talking about Marshall Plans, we're talking about containment, we're talking about West Berlin, and I just wrote a blog saying this ain't a Cold War. but I mean, I guess we could hash a lot of that out in the second half. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion of the fallout from Euromaidan 1 year later and look at a provocative argument Alexander made recently in the pages of the venerable journal Foreign Affairs. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. And also joining us via Skype from New York City is Alexander Motil, a professor at Rutgers University, Newark, and author of numerous books on post-Soviet affairs. I would also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and the newly launched Power Vertical feed at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
I think a long telegram itself, violating all the rules on the length of telegrams, was a pretty edgy thing to do at the time. And it certainly was done with the intention of being edgy, because what Kennan was trying to do was to get people's attention. And breaking the rules on the length of telegrams was a pretty good way to do it at that time.
Well, that was historian John Lewis Gaddis speaking at the Council of Foreign Relations recently about the long telegram and the origins of the Cold War. 67 years and 4 months ago, U.S. diplomat George Kennan published an essay, The Sources of Soviet Conduct, in the journal Foreign Affairs, which became the blueprint for the Western policy of containment. 5 days ago, Rutgers University professor Alexander Motil published an essay, The Sources of Russian Conduct, in that same journal, arguing that Kennan's containment doctrine now needs to be revived. Well, Alexander, I just put you in some pretty illustrious company. Hope you appreciate that. So summarize your argument for our listeners, if you would.
The argument is just a straightforward copy of Kennan's. I was preparing for a course and had to reread Kennan. So, and as I was rereading him, I realized, good Lord, I mean, he could be writing about contemporary Russia. And he posits that Soviet policy is driven by ideology and the primacy of, the need for absolute power within the power structure, and that these two forces conspire to create this need to expand, and that this expansive tendency is always taking place, but it doesn't necessarily have to be immediate. It can shift. It looks for various opportunities. In other words, it's in a kind of opportunistic expansionism. And given that, the appropriate response on the part of the West, according to Cannon, is a long-term strategy. That's extremely important. In other words, it's not just a one-off. It's a long-term strategy, as he called it, containment. Using counterforce, but also what we today would call soft power, in other words, hard power, soft power, and all the means of power in order to contain Soviet, i.e./Russian expansionist tendencies. Well, in any case, it seems to me that Russia today also has this expansionist ideology. It's essentially a neo-imperial Russian ideology. We have the formation within Russia since the mid-2000s of a kind of a highly authoritarian, what I call fascistoid regime, which needs this neo-imperialism as a legitimating ideology for the power and the prestige of the strongman, Mr. Putin, and it's looking for opportunities to expand. There's Georgia, there's the constant saber rattling on Russia's borders, and this has been going on for the last 10, 15 years, and now, of course, Crimea as well as the Donbass. So, what should the West do? And as I said, my argument is very unoriginal. It should follow Kennan's advice. It worked then. It might work now. And that is to say, think of Ukraine as the West Germany and contain Russia by supporting Ukraine, but also the non-Russian states in general, using all sorts of opportunities and means to blunt Russia's energy weapon. And last but not least, apply soft power.
And the militarily as well?
Military supplies, to countries that need it, such as Ukraine. I would not be opposed to lethal weapons for Ukraine.
Sean, your thoughts. Is containment the way to go?
I'm not so sure. It's appealing as a long-term strategy, but it doesn't. I wonder how it's going to deal with the current problem in the Donbass and how I think for containment to actually be applied, that this problem needs to be settled. And I'm not sure how this problem could be settled right now and how a containment policy could fit into it in the long term.
No, Alexander, your answer to that would be basically let Donbass go and be done, wash your hands with it, correct?
Well, there would be two answers to that. One is you want Ukraine to be able to contain the proxies and the Russians in the Donbass. That's important. And that's essentially the strategy, as you know, that Poroshenko seems to be pursuing. There's talk of building these defensive perimeters and things of that sort. Well, for Ukraine to be able to contain these forces, it needs to have the appropriate weaponry. It has much of that, but it certainly needs more. It could certainly use all sorts of communications and radar weapons. It might possibly require training by the United States or other powers. These are all possibilities. I'm not suggesting anything in particular, but Ukraine needs to be able to maintain that front line. So, that is a policy of containment. Would that then result in the ultimate winning back of the Donbass? As you've been saying, I'm perfectly happy to give it up. But in any case, from Kennan's point of view and from my point of view, that wouldn't be the primary issue. The primary issue is to stop the attacks and to make the attacks on Ukrainian territory counterproductive for Russia and its proxies. Mm-hmm. That has to be the priority. As to what happens then with the Donbass, what happens then with the Crimea, I think that's step 10, frankly. Step one is just to freeze this in some fashion or other.
Now, Sean, you had a blog post up arguing very, very articulately and passionately against arming the Ukrainians right now because it might inflame this conflict and turn it into a hot conflict between the West and Russia, which would what would you say to what Alexander is saying?
Well, my reservations are exactly drawing the United States in. If the United States gives weapons to Ukraine, and Russia, of course, yesterday warned against this with Joe Biden going to Kyiv, this will give Putin the reason to escalate even further. And I think he would take this as a sign to escalate even further. And my fear is that it would draw the United States. And then the question is, well, what does the United States and the Europeans do if Putin doubles down? And this could eventually draw the United States and the Europeans into a hot conflict with Russia. And this is, people have made a lot of comparisons to World War I over the last year because of the centennial. And I think this is a potential fragile place that could end up in a larger conflict.
Mm-hmm. Alexander, what do you think?
Well, look, two points. One is despite the fact that the West has not been providing any lethal weaponry to Ukraine over the last 6 months, the conflict has been escalating and Russia has been escalating the conflict. To argue that weapons deliveries would lead to an escalation, well, maybe, maybe not. But the point is, escalation seems to be driven by Russia's own foreign policy or internal political priority. So point number one. Point number two, no one is suggesting, and this, I think, is the source of Sean's fears, no one is suggesting that the United States provides some weapons, Russians escalate, we provide more, and we continually engage in this kind of ratcheting up. That's not the idea. The idea is to enhance Ukraine's defensive capacities so as to make a further Russian escalation painful. That's it. It's not to stop. It's not to make.
And that further Russian escalation, you mean crossing beyond the Donbass?
Crossing beyond the Donbass.
Or trying to take Mariupol.
Starters, it would be perfectly sufficient to provide the Ukrainian army with Javelin anti-tank missiles. These are supposed to be very deadly, very effective. You can't use them in an assault. You would be using them exclusively in a defensive capacity. Let's assume the United States provides, oh, pick a number, 1,000. Let's assume the Russians up the ante. There is no reason, I'm not saying there is no reason whatsoever for the U.S. or the West to provide another 1,000 or another 2,000. Those 1,000 anti-tank missiles would suffice to make a Russian attack extremely painful. And that's all that's an
that's
issue.
All that needs to do, yeah, to be able to inflict.
It's not a question of making the Ukrainians more superior, one that they never will be, nor is it a question of the West blindly ratcheting up the ante. Quite the opposite. Provide them with some assistance to make their capacity to defend themselves stronger. That's it.
Yeah. And it wasn't, I mean, the Russians did warn against arming. It wasn't only in response to Biden's trip to Kyiv. He's there as we speak. But it was Tony Blinken's comments, senior administration official, saying maybe because the administration has been not enthusiastic about this idea. I don't know how to read Blinken's comments, if it signifies a change in policy in the administration or not. One other thing that came to me, just as weird, because, again, this rogue state thing came up in the first half, so I'm going to keep it going. Kennan was talking about containing a superpower. This was a Cold War, and I argue, and I still will argue. I argued on my blog, and we'll continue to argue. This isn't a Cold War because Russia isn't offering a universalist ideology that appeals to anybody. I mean, what are they offering? Gay bashing, basically, in Russian greatness. But more importantly, there isn't any parity between Russia and the West right now. This ain't a Cold War. I lean more towards the rogue state thing, but it's a big nuclear armed rogue state, but a rogue state nonetheless. How do you contain, is there any difference in containing a superpower and containing a rogue state? Is the same principle apply?
If the notion is that the Russians are expanding, I mean, albeit from position of medium range power, then in principle, the containment should be significantly easier. Mm. I mean, you know, I don't think anybody quite expects the Russians to launch nuclear attacks. So it's really more a question of their expansion into bits and pieces of territory occupied by Russians or Russian speakers. So Narva in Estonia, right. Riga in Latvia, northern Kazakhstan, bits and pieces of Belarus, bits and pieces of Ukraine. Although, as you know, the Finns and the Swedes are actually quite terrified, or at least they say they're more terrified. So it's really a question of that. I'm not expecting the Russians to launch a full-scale attack on West Germany. That's obviously going to happen. So that means containment is significantly easier. Mm. You don't have to expend as many resources, presumably. But what you need to have, and I think this is the brilliance of the Kennan piece, you need to have a strategy. The West has to say, okay, this country is a problem. It's going to remain a problem for at least as long as Putin is president. Maybe longer, depending on what the regime will be like after he leaves. But it's going to be a seriously destabilizing force. It will be expanding or attempting to expand in its neighboring areas. This will destabilize the security or architecture of the post-war world. It could easily threaten the security and stability of Europe and other allies. Hence, we need to plan ahead. Mm. You can't simply have the seat of the pants response, oh, we'll put 10 more guys on the blacklist, or we'll do something else. No, you've got to sit down and think this through. So that means, what are the key countries? Well, one of them obviously is Ukraine. Are the Balts as important? My sense is that the answer would have to be yes. Should we be interested in the integrity of Kazakhstan? My guess is that the answer should also be yes. That then has implications for policy. Now, I understand it has an odious regime, Kazakhstan. On the other hand, there may be certain strategic considerations that the West should keep in mind as it formulates policy towards Central Asia, and so on. So how one resolves this is something for the policymakers. But I think the primary message behind Kennan is this needs to be a serious policy. You can't just react, you know, the U.S. does a bit here, the Europeans do a little bit someplace else. No, they've got to coordinate their efforts.
So Nazarbayev's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. I guess I wish Murkoff were here to hear that. But one thing that also comes to mind here is that this is one of the ways that the Soviet Union and current Russia are different. And I pointed this out in my blog, is that the Soviet Union had a stake in the system. It was a status quo power, to use Kissinger's terms. The Russia of today, I don't think is a status. It's the opposite of a status quo power. It's trying. It's doing everything it can to upset the international system. So, I mean, is containing a status quo power, because that's what you had during the Cold War. That's what you had with the Soviet Union. You weren't containing this unpredictable thing that is bent on upsetting the international system. You're basically containing something that basically wanted to maintain this system and liked it. And you see now, because Russia really wants that system back. Because they were considered on par with the West. What do you think, Sean? Is this something to concern us?
I think it is something to concern us, because unlike during the Cold War with the containment, there was never any direct confrontation between Russia and the West. It was all done through proxies, particularly in the post-colonial world or to some extent in Eastern Europe. But this kind of more unpredictable Russia that's not a status quo power, as you say, there is potential danger for more hot flashes in conflict between Russia and Western powers, for sure. My big question about this containment policy is whether the United States and Europe has what it takes to pull it off.
Yes.
Because the United States is perpetually distracted in the Middle East. Europe is based on getting its own house in order. Do they have enough to put the resources necessary to contain Russia? The other question I wonder is how much a containment policy would actually aid Putin. Perhaps this is something that in the back of his mind he hopes for, because it will allow him to re-solidify his power and isolate Russia and have him a reason for a continued existence.
Yeah, no, that's a good point you raise. I mean, both of those points are good. The answer on whether the West has the staying power for this, I just don't. I don't know. I certainly hope so. On the second point, on what Putin wants is contain. I think it's exactly what he wants. I think this is exactly what he wants, because he's doing everything now to make it look like this is a Cold War. He's doing, I mean, he's with the violations of airspace, with the little submarine hunts off the coast of Sweden, with the it's one thing after another where he's trying to make this into it look like to the Russian public like a Cold War. He's talking about parity. This word keeps coming up again and again and again in the Russian media and in the state media, that we have to be treated as equals. Well, parity, this is something that, you know, this is another Cold War term, but we don't have parity now. But essentially, should we even care about that? Because this is the last thing I wanted to get at here is containment also essentially means accepting the domestic arrangements in Russia. Containment wasn't about regime change in the Soviet Union. It was about, you know, at the end of the day, well, I know what you're going to say, Alexander, but is it time? I mean, are we in the short run giving up on the Russian opposition, giving up on the democratization of Europe, understanding that as you contain this over the long term, as Russia loses Ukraine, then you have the potential for democratization in the long term in Russia. Alexander, what do you wanted to jump in there?
I mean, as Kennan said, I mean, the whole point of this is either, you know, the whole point of containment, the ultimate consequences would be either breakdown or reform. I can live with both. By the way, if Putin wants containment, I'd say let's accommodate him. That doesn't preclude the continued support of the Russian opposition, by the way. I mean, you can do both. As a matter of fact, I mean, as you know, I mean, the United States supported all sorts of national resistance movements during containment mm-hmm. in the 1940s and 50s. So one can continue doing that. The important thing here is can a regime which is corrupt, kleptocratic, inefficient, ineffective, and prone to profoundly enormous strategic miscalculations of the kind, such as Putin's, can such a regime survive in the medium to long term if it is at the same time promoting the isolation of an increasingly weaker economy and of an increasingly brittle state? My sense is that for Putin to want containment, and that's why I'm saying we should accommodate him, this is another one of his many strategic miscalculations. Containment, isolation, and this need to focus inwards is a recipe for Russia's disaster. Yeah. It's a recipe for Russia, for the regime's ultimate collapse. So if he wants to do this, who are we to say no?
Well, they do have go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, the one thing I wanted to bring up is the fact that the United States and Europe aren't the rest of the world. And that certainly a containment policy on the part of the United States and Europe could happen. But what about Brazil, India, China, and other smaller powers in Asia and in South America, engagement with Russia? Russia could make like it's pivoting towards China. It could also make overtures to these other states as well.
Those are the states. Oh, go ahead, Alexander.
During the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the Soviet Union had alliances with all sorts of countries. I mean, that didn't preclude containment. And the difference then was the Soviet Union was the highly industrialized state, and it had alliances with underdeveloped countries. At this point in time, Putin's pursuit of an alliance with China will lead to the underdevelopment of Russia. I say all the more power to him. We should promote these sorts of tendencies, and sooner or later he will collapse, and then people like Nemtsov and the democratic opposition will emerge as the victors.
Yeah, and when you look at countries like, I mean, let's look at BRICS. I mean, I call it a bunch of middle-range powers clinging to China, basically. But, I mean, if you look at it, China's another case entirely. I mean, China's going to be the senior partner in any Sino-Russian alliance. But India, South Africa, Brazil, they're going to play their own game, too. These are rising powers. And they're going to go with the side of the world that's more dynamic, one would think, at the end of the day. So that worries me less. And the other thing is, I mean, this Kremlin has just such a tendency to overplay its hand. I mean, one item I saw this week, another LNG terminal is going to be built in Estonia. One's already up online in Lithuania. They're building a pipeline between Finland and Estonia. The energy equation's going to change. I keep saying this over and over and over and over like a mantra. But it's important. Once the energy equation changes, guess what? Putin doesn't have any money to pay for anything. He's going to have his hands full keeping his kleptocratic elite happy enough not to be at his throat. So, I mean, once the money dries up, they really got nothing but the nukes. And God knows.
And then the Ivory Coast with the bomb.
Right. We're bumping up against the end here. That's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Also joining us via Skype from New York City has been Alexander Motil, a professor at Rutgers University, Newark, and author of numerous books on post-Soviet affairs. Thank you both for the fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome and indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow, at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and the newly launched Power Vertical feed at rfrl.org. And you could follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast will take next week off as the United States celebrates Thanksgiving and endures Black Friday. But we'll be back in action on December 5th. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.